Hi, and welcome to another edition of Point of View. I'm your host, Chandra Ligatfalvi. Today in the program, we have the Focus editor from the Brock Press, Vic Muccheroni, in the studio to talk about austerity and privatization at Brock University. On the telephone, we're hearing from Jordan Koop, who was escorted off campus at Western University for daring to reach out to first years with material about tuition costs in Ontario. But before we get into that, we're going to follow up on last week's story about the disaffiliation campaign at the Canadian Federation of Students. Last week, we spoke with Ashley Engel. You can find that conversation at facebook.com/POVradio. In response to her comments, we have on the telephone Muhammad Akbar, a University of Windsor student executive, who asked to come on the program and respond to the issues that she's raised. We're going to have those interviews after the local headlines. At Brock University, the Brock University Students Administrative Council, known as BUSAC, met this week for their first meeting of the semester. I attended the meeting and listened in as we heard presentations from each of the executives. The content of these presentations can be found at busu.net by clicking on representation and viewing minutes and meetings. As has been the tradition for nearly a year at BUSAC, the only individual to ask questions during open question period was me. So the questions I asked were following up on the news of the semester. We're dealing with the President's Task Force. So I asked the BUSU President, how does he view his role on the President's Task Force? We're going to have Cooper Millard on the program to talk about the President's Task Force, as well as some of the referendums. We are also going to be following up on the student life fee. Last semester, there was a referendum for a $20 per credit student life fee, which was distributed to the administration. The individual responsible at the administration is Kim Mead, who is the provost of student services. I've contacted Kim Mead about the student life fee, and she's invited me to a student life referendum committee meeting, which we're having this week. And I'm going to learn about the implementation of the student life fee moving forward. The other questions that I brought up at BUSAC last night was, what is the status of the new student center? And we heard from the BUSU's president, and you can view this in his presentation PDF, which is a slideshow presentation, about the new student center, which they say will go to focus groups this week. Go to focus groups this year ahead of putting shovels in the ground at some future date for some future executives. And that was sort of all we had from BUSAC this week. We're going to be following up with the BUSU president to find out more about his point of view on the President's Task Force and on the referendums, as well as we're going to be talking with the Vice President of Finances and Administration, Christopher Yent, about a new bylaw, which had its second reading yesterday, which at the last BUSAC meeting, which is Bylaw 4200, the Referendum Implementation Review Committee, which will be responsible for reviewing current ancillary fees, as well as helping to field new referendums as they come up. So let us get to our interviews. Now we're going to have a conversation with Muhammad Akbar, the University of Windsor student executive, to talk about the Canadian Federation of Students. So we're joined on the line by Muhammad Akbar, a University of Windsor student executive, who heard our conversation last week with Ashley Engel, who is the spokesperson for a campaign to disaffiliate from the Canadian Federation of Students. Thanks for joining us again on the program.
No problem.
So what is your perspective on what you heard from Ashley's comments last week?
So I actually think Ashley is great. I've met her several times. We worked on things in meetings, and I agree with a lot of the stuff she wants to do. Basically, my perspective on the disaffiliation campaign is that I don't think this was the right time for a disaffiliation campaign. I feel like we've been accomplishing a lot through CFS meetings, and I think that we have the potential to do a lot more, and that, you know, the defederation campaign kind of distracts from that. But, you know, people are planning to leave, they should go for it, right? If you feel that it's in the best interest of your membership to disaffiliate from the CFS, that's cool. But I do think that focusing on reformation and trying to fix the things you see as issues, which of course, like every organization has. I think that's what the focus should be on. And I do think it's possible. I do think it's possible to fix some of the issues people see with CFS. I know there are some, and I have a problem with some of them too, but I do think that the overall focus should be on reformation. And you know, because the things like the CFS, things like student unions are always changing. And saying that, I realize at times it does get frustrating to the point where you realize that it isn't a service to your membership to stay in an organization. You know, we felt that last year when we had our referendum on the Ontario Undergraduate Student Alliance. But with the CFS, I don't think that the CFS is hopeless, and I don't think that this was the time to push for a defederation. You know what I mean? Like,
what's your background with the CFS in terms of how do you glean your differentiation between the USA being not worth University of Windsor students' time, but the CFS still being worth your stakeholders' time?
So a couple things. I've had experience with both organizations. I did spend 1 year on the executives of both, the steering committee and the executive committee, one for USA, one for CFS. But before that, I did do my research on both organizations when I was just a student kind of learning about the university and the student union. So I think the reason that I feel less, well, I think it's pretty much what we tried to do in CFS and USA. With USA, I don't think I proposed a motion that passed. I think everything I suggested failed. And actually, at the I believe it was the November meeting. I don't remember. I believe it was the November AGM last year when USA was pushing to raise a fee increase on USA, like on the USA fee. I actually suggested that we would have a referendum on that prior to the voting on that motion, and actually asked. I actually asked if the motion could be held off, or if we could, you know, be allowed to put this to a referendum. But you know, it wasn't. The motion failed, and USA moved forward with a fee increase that they asked us to pass on to our membership without a referendum. And they suggest that we should just have a referendum and it's not a big deal. And then, of course, the referendum happened. And you know, I've talked about the issues with that referendum and what the actual response to that was. With the CFS, we actually, you know, one of the things we pushed for was putting minutes online. And that motion actually passed. So, like, very soon, minutes of, you know, CFS annual general meetings are going to be on the website. And right now, one of the motions that I think is really important, especially in the context of what's going on, is we had a motion to try and live stream the meetings. And so it was explained to me after we submitted the motion by someone who's not related to CFS, but was just a friend of mine when I was talking to them about this. And they kind of explained how complicated it was. So the motion didn't pass, but it was referred for further investigation to see if it's possible. And I think focusing on motions like that and developing ways to get those motions passed and developing strategies to implement those motions is a lot more important than pushing for defederation campaigns. But I'm really speaking from Windsor's context. I can't really speak for the graduate student union who pushed a lot of other things.
Here at Brock University, the Graduate Student Administration is a member of the Canadian Federation of Students. And yesterday I was reading through this year's GSA planner, and it had about 20 pages of content courtesy of the CFS, which outlined how disproportionate tuition prices are in Ontario compared to the rest of the province, and really did set the tone for a variety of the more budgetary education issues. The material is right there in the planner for the graduate students. And so I just wanted to put that out there, that is there, that content exists in your graduate student planner. And I think that's what you said is part of the benefits of the CFS. But if I may just continue for a second, I've been doing some reading about it. And I read an article that drew a differentiation between the CFS, which is an advocacy operation, and CFS services, which is deals with corporate affiliations. Do you see any validity to the criticism of the CFS trending more towards CFS services and less towards CFS proper?
So I'm not exactly sure what the criticism was, but the way I've seen it is because of how the structure, because CFS is a federation of various provincial and national groups, the way it was formed actually, and this all happened around the 1980s, and my history obviously is like I haven't done enough research to, I've learned quite a bit about it, but not enough to really understand why the CFS works the way it does. But right now it's sort of like the idea behind the structure was that, you know, you're merging a services organization called AOSC with the National Union of Students, which was the national group at the time. And they didn't want the services to overcome the advocacy, and they didn't want the advocacy to overcome the services. So that was kind of the issue they ran into. And I do think the structure could be changed. And I think there are ways to change it. I'd like to explore those changes with other universities and try and find out a good way to create a mix of, you know, because the idea is, you know, like you mentioned, the graduate student planners are actually printed by CFS. That's why they have that content, which explains how CFS works. So, and post-secondary education. So the idea behind the structure of CFS is they want the services and the advocacy to work together, to the point where general meetings of the CFS, I believe, are meetings of CFS and CFS services so that you can have all the business done at once. But it's a lot more complicated than that, right? So, and this is taking like 30 years to find the structure that sort of works. And I do think there's flaws in it. I don't know how much I agree with the idea that the services are just a scheme of CFS to make money. The way I see CFS is that it's a service union. So it advocates and it provides services. And, you know, the services can always be improved. And there could be a debate on whether services or advocacy is more appropriate. I know that USA is entirely an advocacy lobby organization, like a lobby group. And some people do want to see CFS become that, but I'm not entirely convinced that we should give up services. I know when we switched to the CFS handbooks this year, we used to be with another company, we saved a few $1,000s, and that was only because we picked the most expensive handbooks with stickers and everything. Had we chosen like a more condensed version, we would have saved even more. So I'm not convinced that the services are entirely bad. I do think a balance needs to be reached, and we do need to figure out a new structure, but like I'm going to be gone soon, so I'll leave that to future student unions to figure out how to do it.
So is there really any argument that the CFS interferes or precludes the development of a provincial student movement? Ashley Engel's perspective seems to want to, I'm not trying not to put words in her mouth. You can, of course, listen to the broadcast at facebook.com/POV radio to hear what she had to say for herself. But the Ontario needs a Quebec student movement is essentially the perspective that I am gleaning from that conversation. Does the CFS stand in the way of that in any way?
I don't think so. I do agree that we need a Quebec-style student movement. I mean, I've been on board with the arguments, and there's been debates in CFS about how to organize towards that. It's not that anybody disagrees that we need mass mobilizations or larger mobilizations, but the issue that like me and Ashley and others who have tried to immediately push for, you know, a Quebec-style movement is people have been saying, like, we're not ready. Our members aren't ready yet. And that was one of the biggest arguments against immediately starting to organize towards you know, like a student strike or something. Like the idea was, you know, we have to educate our members first, get everybody educated. Then we have to start working on smaller mobilizations, and then slowly but surely we'll build up towards the strike. And the idea was actually, and this is just a perspective from the other side. It was the idea that, you know, for example, a school has a small population. They've never done mobilizations. They've never even done education on tuition fees. Can they just drop everything and start organizing for a strike? We thought that the strike was more of a tactic towards a larger goal of free education, and that we should be mobilizing towards that. And the compromise that was reached was creating a provincial action plan and, you know, an organizing guide and helping people ramp up their mobilizations and educating students. That's sort of where CFS stands right now. I don't think what CFS will be a barrier if a grassroots student mobilization happens. No one can stand in the way of that, and I think CFS will facilitate that to an extent. And I know that's not a popular opinion among those who about the 100 people that talk about this, but I do think that the Federation does play an important role in future mobilizations and in post-secondary education in the future, especially in Ontario.
Do you see a pathway towards inspiring an Ontario movement? You've said that you feel it's necessary. What would its principles be in, and what would part of the approach be in terms of, obviously there's the education aspect, and then there's the mobilization aspect. So do you have a vision in mind for that?
I think it's going to come from rebuilding our student unions, trying to figure out ways that student unions can be more direct democratic. I know our student union, I don't feel is very close, but I think that we're getting there and we want to work towards it. I think a good step is having more general meetings and giving more decisions, like having councils. I think I talked about this the first time I came on. Having student unions willfully give power back to students in the forms of referendums, which is what I think is the best, in the form of, you know, general meetings, if that's what people prefer, general assemblies, and eventually breaking student unions down to more loose coalitions of student societies and you know, faculty organizing. Faculty organizing is a big part of the Quebec style of student organizing, and I think that's really cool, and it creates a more direct connection with students. And I think that is the way to go. But, you know, while some schools want to push towards that, other schools resist that kind of organizing. And I don't think that all schools will, you know, join in on a Quebec student organizing type of endeavor. But I don't think that's the goal, for example, of the Defederation movement. I think people don't feel that the way they want to organize is happening in CFS, and they want to try something new. But I think that the thing I disagree with the most is, trying to encourage defederation from CFS but not providing an alternative. 4 years ago, the UWSA wasn't advocating on tuition fees. They were actually advocating, like, you know, they'd vote against the tuition fees at the Board of Governors, but aside from that, people basically started talking about how tuition fees going up was inevitable. And at one point, we had, you know, our representatives on the Board of Governors vote, like, not against. They just abstained from the vote. And when we started getting more involved with CFS, I mean, CFS did help us. So I'm not convinced that that CFS should be just tossed out. And I haven't. I would have liked to see the new organization and the new organizing group founded before, like, a mass defederation campaign. And I think there's a couple blogs out that are really good. There's a student at McMaster who wrote a really nice blog about how, you know, maybe the principles of some of the work that this defederation campaign is doing are good, but they're essentially hurting students through this campaign. It was an interesting blog. I think it would be good reading just to kind of get different perspectives on.
Yeah, could you post that? We're going to post this conversation, obviously, to facebook.com/POV Radio. Would you jump on there and post a couple links for us, some reading material for our listeners?
For sure.
Yeah, we're just about out of time for this conversation. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We're talking with Muhammad Akbar, a student executive from the University of Windsor. And thanks again for sharing your point of view.
No problem.
Next up is an interview with Vic Mucheroni, the focus editor of the Brock Press. And then later in the hour, we're talking with Jordan Koop from Western University, who was escorted off campus with a protest group which was handing out flyers about student prices of tuition prices in Ontario. And we'll be talking to those individuals after the break.
Are you currently in school and need volunteer hours? Or are you just looking to give back to your community? Either way, Epilepsy Niagara would like to speak to you. Epilepsy Niagara works throughout the entire Niagara region to help support people affected by epilepsy and their families. Did you know that there are approximately 5,000 people in the Niagara region living with epilepsy or a seizure disorder? Epilepsy Niagara has several fundraisers throughout the year to help raise funds to continue to offer programs to those who need them. By volunteering to help out, you'll not only be having fun and making the event successful, you'll also be helping to continue to educate and create public awareness about epilepsy. If you'd like to get involved and help out as a volunteer at Epilepsy Niagara, give them a call at 905-353-1096 or log on to their website at epilepsyniagara.org.
We're joined in the studio by Brock Press Focus editor Vic Muccheroni, who's a sociology major, and she comes on the program today to talk about a recent article available at brockpress.com called Austerity, Neoliberalism, and Brock University. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So your piece identifies privatization as central to the trends on campus. Can you take me through your thought process and how you gained your research and put this piece together?
Sure. I've been interested in neoliberalism, not because I'm interested in economics per se, but it just seemed to come up a lot in my research with sociology, talking about how certain inequalities that people have been experiencing.
And how do we define neoliberalism?
Neoliberalism started in the 1930s, but it was informed by economists such as Adam Smith's notion of, say, the invisible hand. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that, but it's basically economic solutions to structure a society where people who want to see neoliberal policies exist, they do not want government intervention in most policies, and they want decentralization. They want to promote individualism and decentralization of the economy. So they basically want market rule.
How do you define austerity?
Austerity is when the government has been borrowing from private sector for certain things like loans, things like that, and then they go into deficit, so they're trying to get out by cutting social services. So austerity is a short-term answer, in my mind, for people's choices.
What do we take me through this article that's available at the Brock Press in the latest edition, in the September 5th edition, is it? September 3rd edition?
Yep, September 3rd.
In the September 3rd edition, it's Austerity, Neoliberalism, and Brock University. So tie those trends together for us.
Sure. So Brock University is not the only institution that is going through these kinds of trends.
How's it exemplified here at Brock?
Here at Brock, the administration thinks that austerity is the answer to the deficit that Brock has incurred over the last few years. So by the logic of neoliberalism, getting out of the deficit is important. So that means cutting through the margins, like cutting where they can.
So Brock University right now is undergoing a president's task force, and this is something that your piece has covered.
Okay. I was interested in Bufa's perspective when a professor of mine sent out their response to the president's task force. So I was starting to follow what they were critiquing, and I felt like it was a good representation of...
Well, what have you learned? You did some interviews with some professors, and there's an interesting quote in the piece from that. Oh, it's at Ryerson University. Carlo Finelli, an instructor at Ryerson University, understands that neoliberal proponents view knowledge as a commodity and education as a means of making money that must be privatized and made profitable. Quote, increasingly then, democratic control over resources, knowledge production, and public space is monopolized by private interests with no other aim but to make a profit. Is that what's happening here at Brock University?
I would say so. I think it's important to talk about the larger trends that's going on in Canada and throughout the world, because austerity and privatization have been driving these. Responses to institutions being in a deficit. So a lot of institutions, they're not being able to compete on the global market. That's the logic of capitalism, right? So institutions traditionally were not supposed to be for that reason. They were not supposed to make profits, but over time, capitalists start to understand that the education is an industry. The education industry is very profitable, so you're going to see a lot of people investing within the institutions. So if Brock can't keep up, then they're going to be looking at other options rather than being publicly funded. But right now, they're still publicly funded. So in the meantime, they're going to be cutting programs just to concentrate on certain ones that do make a pretty penny.
We've also been covering the President's Task Force here on this program.
Yeah.
And we talked to Dr. Linda Rose Krasner from BUFA, the Brock University Faculty Association.
Mm-hmm.
We also talked to Dr. Murray Knudela, who's the provost of academic with the university, basically the number two in command. And so you can look at our archive at facebook.com/POVradio or cfbu.ca/archive.html to get caught up on that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking with Vic Mucheroni, the focus editor for the Brock Press and a sociology major. Vic, how are you so able to clearly identify capitalism itself? Where do you draw the confidence to be able to speak so clearly about capitalism per se?
Just because I don't think that the research shows that state and pure economic solutions are benefiting human society no longer, even beyond humans. We cannot really go on any longer having solutions that are reinforcing the same sort of inequalities we see in this world. And I just want to stress that this article that I wrote, it seems like it could be two issues. So, like, we see, like, the President's Task Force as something going on at Brock, but I want to be able to facilitate critical understanding of Brock is a microcosm, and people should not look at it as an isolated institution. It exists in a world where markets are the prominent thing that runs our society now. Capitalism is everywhere. It is ubiquitous. So I think it works better if it's invisibilized. So if we do not name capitalism, then we're just sort of sweeping it under the rug. So if we name it, then we could start talking about the trends that it has formed.
It's talking about the symptoms instead of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
To not name it, is what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And Nathan...
Is it Kekin?
Yeah, Nathan Kekin did some really great research, and I hope that people could look it up. He is vice president of QP Unit 1 at Brock University, and I hope that more than just the members get to see what he's been talking about. He's been doing research on really like the commodification of education and what direction it's going in, so basically what sells. And that research is being done by economists and people within the business departments in universities, ironically enough. So they're producing knowledge that's reinforcing the same sort of solutions that we see. So that to me is very troubling. Social sciences have traditionally been outspoken and have always had a radical history. And I think that's really important when we see different perspectives giving different solutions. So the big paradox that I think is that when budget cuts happen, this has been the trend in Canada. We could see this happening. I could name like a few different universities who've had art programs cut. So art programs are like the humanities.
Well, what's the argument to be made against, I think they call it differentiation, where this university, this institution says, well, you come to this institution for what makes it different. And so under that argument, they would say, therefore, we can cut certain programs because if you want those programs, just go somewhere else. Is there a reason to have a full spectrum academic approach at every institution?
I think it should be important to still have those critical courses available to students, and I guess it's up to the people who are taking the courses, which is Brock is utilizing that rhetoric, though. They're basically saying it's for the students' own benefit, that we're going to be cutting whatever. They're not saying that they're cutting anything right now, but the trends say that social sciences are usually on the chopping block.
Right, that's what we're hearing as well. But what the Dr. Knudela told us is that this is an information gathering exercise where the president's task force will gather information and present that information to Senate, who's responsible for the academic reassessment. What Dr. Rose Krasner told us was that the top 20% of – they're going to assess all the organizations on campus, all the programs and so forth. The top 20% will be reinvested in, and the bottom 20% will be cut, is essentially what she suggested.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like they're going to be leaving any room for rebuttal on that. So the president's task force is not going to be deciding what gets cut, but they're going to be providing the information, which I'm sure, I think the president will be deciding. That seems wrong, though. Could you correct me on that?
The president's task force reports to the president, and then that will inform the president's presentation to Senate, is what I understand so far.
Mm-hmm.
The other point that Bufa raised was that the president's task force is being conducted in a very short time period. So even if the best interests are in mind for why this task force should be taking place, under this argument, Bufa is now stating clearly that they want the president's task force to stop entirely.
Yeah, I think that was the most startling thing that I read from Bufa's critique. It was scary to see because program reviews at other universities, they went over an 18-month period, and collectively they took 1 million hours from the faculty to fill out the reports. And that is quite a lot of time being taken away from the quality of education just to be filling out these things that's going to maybe decide whether or not they're going to have a job in the future. Yeah, I think that the task force not hearing Bufa's really rational argument on not having enough time to go through this process just makes you kind of question what's the rush? Like, why can't you just wait? Not wait, but
some of the questions we have will be like, how did they not see this coming? Therefore, what is the rush? I mean, we have an institution that's been building a lot of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they have budgets that they know what is in and out of the budget. So how does this happen is the question that we have moving forward.
I think that they just blindly adopted Dixon's model. So I talk about in the article, and Bufa also mentioned the concerns. And also, Nathan also mentioned that Brock basically took Robert Dixon's model that other universities use for program review suggestions, and they applied it so that they would get a result. And which is interesting to me is that he's coming from the perspective as an economist, once again reinforcing the idea that the people with the same sort of knowledge base are telling us about the solutions.
So does the people or the students need to do the research for themselves and come to their own determination as to what are the solutions? And if they do somehow believe that they have a solution in mind, a vision for what would be a better future, a progressive answer, whom do they bring that answer to? Do we bring that to the doorstep of the administration and say, you know, fix this?
Mm-hmm.
Do we bring that to the doorstep of the provincial government? Whom do we approach with the critique?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I bring neoliberalism into it, and I talk about how it champions individualism. So I think that students, if they want to speak out against this, I don't want to be negative about it, but neoliberalism has already done a lot of damage with people and how they view how they view their education, or how they review how they have relationships outside of themselves, basically. So students, if they want to help out, then they'll, I would hope that they're going to talk to other faculty members and try to think of this as a collective issue. So it's not just faculty that their programs and their jobs are going to be at risk. I think that is a very short-sighted thing. And I think that when faculty members of BUFA speak out, they're not really trying to save their future jobs. They're trying to save the quality of education, because certain programs should be existing. Like, it, there's just countless people that want to be involved in those programs, and the administration, by saying that it's not worth it financially, then that's just creating this whole environment of that we only value things that make profit, you know?
When you talk about neoliberal damage, what are you referring to? What is the damage of neoliberalism upon individuals?
Internalizing the logic. It's not just an economic model, it's actually a cultural model too.
Yeah, flesh that out for me, because I'm not sure I understand.
Mm-hmm. So if you have like a market-based society, people start to value what neoliberalism wants people to value.
So is an example of this where I'll buy a coffee and 10 cents of that coffee goes to some sort of charity? Where the solution is wrapped up into the consumption?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think there's a lot of examples out there.
What's another example on campus? How do we identify the neoliberalism as
I have one. So we look at this problem and we see that our degree is only a year away, so we don't care about it because we're going to be done our schooling in a year and it's not going to affect us. Thinking individually like that is going to cause a lot of problems, and it already has, because we're not acting for other people anymore. We're acting for ourselves. And I know, and also with neoliberalism is that we have, well, just basically capitalism for that matter, we don't have enough time to really talk out for other people. We're kind of consumed with just doing things to survive. We don't have enough time in our daily lives to go outside ourselves and volunteer anymore. So that poses another problem.
How do you apply yourself towards building collective solutions?
Building collective solutions? I don't have all the answers to that, but...
But you do have things that you engage in. Maybe take me through... What is your approach as a writer, and then what is your approach as a person here in Niagara Region?
As a writer, I want to be as open as possible and talk to people who have marginal perspectives. I don't necessarily want to interview administration, but I will if I have to. I would like to talk to people who... also have radical perspectives, because I don't think that they're talked about enough, and we often think about things in a very depoliticized manner, especially at Brock University. And in my own personal life, I like to do things outside of state and economic solutions, like I'm trying to talk about with you. Like, we need to get past those solutions. So what do I do in my daily life? Is that what you want to know?
Yeah, well, I'm curious, because I know that you're engaged in a variety of things in this community.
Sure. So. I really like organizing around food security issues, because I find it intersectional, and it does have a radical history when you connect food to why people aren't eating and where the money's really going. If you follow the money, you could understand that poverty in our community is connected with the municipal, provincial, and federal funneling of money into things that really aren't going to be helping.
Is this the kind of topic you're going to be pursuing in the coming weeks at the Brock Press?
I'll probably be writing about food security. It's a topic that I think needs to be discussed more.
We're talking with Vic Muccheroni, a sociology major and a focus editor at the Brock Press. How can we get a hold of you? And maybe take us through some of the other things that you're looking forward to in this semester.
You could email me at focus@brockpress.com, or you could find me in my office on Wednesdays from 2 to 4. I forget what the Brock Press room number is. I think it's like 203.
Okay. Yeah, that's
really
in the Student Alumni Center.
Mm-hmm.
At the right next to where the Harveys is.
Yeah.
And Oberg.
Yeah, send me an email or whatever. I like talking to people about these issues. What am I looking forward to at the Brock Press or
mm-hmm.
at the
Yeah, what other issues will you be covering this year?
Well, I did like 2 months of research on this program review because I wanted to give a good background of like what was really fueling it and like the larger trends, and I think that it was pretty good. So in the near future, I'll just be writing more things that are going on in this world, but give a good background of like the history that really fueled it. Next week, I think I'm going to write about feminist science fiction, so I have a wide variety of things that I like to write about.
Well, we look forward to reading those in the Brock Press. Thank you so much for coming into Brock Radio to talk to me.
Thank you.
When someone mentions football, do you think of the FA Cup, not the Super Bowl? Do you think Little Britain is 10 times funnier than anything on U.S. network television? If you answered yes to either of these, then you're ready to expand your musical horizons with The British Are Coming. 2 hours of the best in British alternative, rock, and electronica from the past 30 years. Join me, DJ Matt D, every Wednesday at 11 as we bring music from across the pond onto your radio on CFBU 103.7 FM.
We're joined now on the telephone by Jordan Koop, who was escorted off campus at Western University for distributing material and hosting a protest during orientation week. Let's take a listen to that conversation.
Yeah, no, I'm a fifth-year student at the University of Western Ontario. My major is media studies, and it's the Faculty of Information and Media Studies at Western University. A group of activists on campus at Western that was created very recently over the past summer, sort of out of the recognition that there lacked a sort of uniting body under which activists at Western could organize. And so a few of us wanted to demonstrate or at least raise awareness about the rising cost of education and student debt. But we lacked the sort of formal channel through which to do so, so we created the Western Solidarity Network because we all knew people who have sort of been thinking about this sort of stuff, but lacked a venue to express their discontent. So we created the Western Solidarity Network as a sort of means to connect various activists and student struggles together and with an emphasis on direct action. In orientation week, so the... what orientation week consists of at Western is basically it's a week-long sort of festival where students are welcome to the university, and the purported function of which is to orient them to what university life will be like. A week at Western, it's affectionately known as a week at Western sort of takes on this big party atmosphere, and there are a lot of concerts, loud music, chanting, and that sort of thing, which is, I think, fairly typical of most orientation weeks. So we thought, and we being the Western Solidarity Network, we thought this would provide a perfect opportunity to sort of raise awareness about what we see as the reality of university experience, but which is sort of absent from orientation week. And so we thought that first-year students are bound to be affected by these realities, the financial realities of tuition fees and student debt, but that orientation week as a sort of welcoming experience lacked this discourse, and so we sought to raise awareness about these issues.
So how did you present yourselves? You've set the stage, so how did you dress? How many people were involved?
There were, it was a very small group of us who went to demonstrate. There were eight of us who went down to what is called Talbot Bowl, and this is sort of where the majority of the events are held. So there's a gated area in which the events are held, and then we stood outside, about 30 or 40 feet outside of that venue, and we were holding signs. They read things like, there were for sale signs, and they said things like, for sale, education, for sale, your orientation week, and these sorts of things, because aside from the rising cost of tuition and student debt, we also wanted to raise awareness about the influence of corporate interests on campus, and many of which sponsor orientation week and advertise directly to students. And so we, accompanying our signs, we also handed out pamphlets that contained statistics and arguments about our cause. And we stood on the sidelines and handed out these pamphlets to students who expressed interest. So we would ask students that were passing by if they've ever thought about tuition or ever wondered why it's so expensive. And if they express interest, we would give them a pamphlet and tell them to read it and then tell them to contact us if the content interested them.
So, but this drew attention of the Orientation Week organizers, and they responded in what way?
Yeah, so shortly after we arrived and began handing out pamphlets, we were confronted by what seemed to be an event planner. So this fellow who seemed fairly disgruntled at the time, had no apparent connection to Western, but obviously had a vested interest in ensuring that the event that was happening that evening, which was opening ceremonies, was to run smoothly without, I guess, the inconvenience of protest or demonstration. And so he approached us and said, you guys can't be here, to which we said, well, we're students on our own campus, just handing out information in the spirit of critical engagement. And he said, well, you guys can't be here. And we said, well, we're not going to leave. And then he informed us that the police were coming, the campus police, that is. And so then shortly after that, we had a few executives from our student council, the University Student Council at Western. And these are executives from what they call the Student Life Department. And this is essentially the risk management sector of our student government. So they deal with regulations and policies for campus in general. And so they said that, again, we can't be here. And they said so because it was a frosh event. And then they again informed us that the police were coming. So eventually we had been out there for maybe 20 minutes, and then the police had arrived. They told us that we were to leave. And then they took us. They took our student cards and names, and they wrote down our student numbers as well, and then asked us to leave. And that was sort of the end of our presence there.
So did you disperse, or did you leave campus, or, you know, change your outfits and just hang out, or, like, what happened after that?
So after that, and if you've read any of the press reports, there's an article in the London Free Press as well as in our student newspaper, the Western Gazette. There's some discrepancy. Administration has denied the claim that we were asked to leave campus entirely, but rather that we were just asked to relocate to another area on campus. The consensus, however, amongst those of us who were there was that the police had asked us to leave, and we asked if we could get our bicycles from another area on campus, and they allowed us to do that. But the wish of the police was clear in that we were to leave the event. And also I think the claim that suggests that we were to relocate is also besides the point, and to focus on that issue is to focus on sort of the peripheries of the issue.
So on what authority did the campus police have to even ask you to do anything?
Yeah, no, they claim that because this general area was a frosh event, that we were not frosh and therefore not to be there.
So what is frosh?
Oh, sorry, a frosh is the colloquial term for first-year students here at Western. So, yeah, they said that, you know, this event was for first-year students and that that we weren't to be there as a result. But the thing was, we weren't inside the event, we were outside of it, and therefore on campus. And so we were asked to leave on those grounds. But, again, the discrepancy between being asked to leave campus entirely or to relocate is, as I said, besides the point, because relocate us to another area on campus was effectively to dismantle our demonstration, because every other area during this time in orientation week on campus is deserted. All the first-year students, and these are the students to whom we directed our message, were in one location. So to relocate us was to essentially put us in an area where there was nobody and to dismantle the demonstration.
So what does your student union do in terms of helping orient the frosh to understand these larger issues, these debt issues, tuition issues, and so forth? I mean, is there any material provided by the student union during orientation week on those topics?
No, there's absolutely nothing provided by our University Students Council to educate students about the realities of tuition fees and student debt, and this is precisely why we thought orientation week was a good place to do so, because this sort of discourse, an important one and an inevitable one for students, is entirely absent from orientation week. So we took it upon ourselves to educate students in light of the failure of our students' council to do so.
So who is putting these frosh for sale? Who is turning orientation week into a commercial experience? At Western, where do you think the responsibility lies for those issues?
Well, it seems that the Western administration has certain allegiances with corporations on campus. I mean, which in our current economic climate makes sense. But I think what's interesting here is that corporate interests on campus during orientation week are present, and not only present, but aggressive. And for example, in our community center, all week we had representatives from companies like Bell and Rogers handing out information directly to students. During orientation week, where as we were also handing out information in a far less aggressive manner, but were removed from campus. So obviously Western administration has welcomed these groups onto campus, but I think what's concerning to me is that our students' union hasn't, and again, to call it a students' union is disingenuous. They would reject the term. They call themselves a students' council, but our students' council sort of has failed to address these concerns and has, in fact, welcomed corporations and marketing firms and advertisement on campus.
So what does this say about the education culture in post-secondary?
I think it speaks to a larger picture within the contemporary university. And we see increasingly that the university has adopted the prevailing economic ideology of essentially capitalism. And we have here in this sort of event what's taken place is that the university has prioritized corporate communications over the communications of their very own students. And this is, to us, an incredibly concerning trend, especially for freedom of expression and freedom of assembly and a number of other things. And I think it sort of betrays the fundamental spirit of the university, in which you can engage in critical discourse, debate complex ideas, and not be removed from campus for doing so.
So I'm looking now at the PDF of the pamphlet that you were handing out. The PDF's called Western Incorporated, and it covers the cost of education. It references the corporate university and asks about the best student experience. We're going to post a link to this document at facebook.com/POVradio. So what can you tell us about sort of the underlying themes that we're looking at in terms of Western Inc.?
The underlying themes of the pamphlet itself sort of explored, one, the rising cost of education, two, the corporatization of academia and the university more generally, and three, how these trends sort of manifest themselves in orientation week. And so we wanted to sort of bring up these large and sort of complex issues in such a way that resonated with first-year students, because unlike other people on campus, namely administrators and the Students' Council, we like to treat our first-year students as intelligent beings and like to think that they can engage in these sorts of discourses without being offended or feeling uncomfortable. And in fact, this is likely the reason that they came to university, is to discuss ideas and these sorts of things. And so thrust behind the pamphlet was to raise awareness about these themes, again, you know, tuition, student debt, and sort of corporate influence on campus. And then we wanted to tie those themes into a direct and concrete experience for first-year students, and that being orientation week. And Western likes to advertise its orientation week as the quote-unquote best student experience. And so we thought by adopting and subverting the language of the administration, we could garner interest from first-year students.
What's the what is the condition where a solidarity network needs to independently emerge? What are the affiliations that your group participates in, and what's its official status? And you know, tell me a little bit more about Western Solidarity Network.
Yeah, so currently we have no official status. We are entirely independent of our Students' Council, as well as the university. It's really just a small group of students who meet weekly and sort of discuss things and practice direct democracy and sort of horizontal organization. So we have no ties to other groups on campus as of now. There are groups who have reached out to us after the results of the demonstration. So there was an article that was written that sort of went viral in our networks here, and a lot of groups reach out to us, including the Faculty of Information and Media Studies deans. So the dean sent out an email to the entire faculty expressing support and concern. We have graduate groups, the Society of Graduate Students, who have reached out to us expressing interest to work with us. Our faculty association here, as well as CAUT, which is the Canadian Association of University and Teachers, has reached out and offered support. And a lot of these groups have expressed in some way or another the possibility of collaboration. But given that our group, the Western Solidarity Network, is still very much in its infancy, we haven't solidify these ties yet, and so currently we operate completely independently of other groups, but I think the point of the network is ultimately to bridge gaps between various groups on campus and sort of connect struggle.
Absolutely, and part of the point of this broadcast is to build connections with other campuses and to understand what their cultural experience is. So we've been talking with a variety of individuals on the show. We've talked to the Ontario Undergraduate Student Alliance. We're speaking with someone who is displeased with the Canadian Federation of Students. And as well, we're going to be talking with someone who's going to be defending that organization. So we're going really to a much larger perspective than campus by campus. And we're looking at really at provincial and national level, what's going on in terms of education issues and the commonalities between each campus. And so do you have a perspective on You know, the provincial situation at a provincial level. What is happening for post-secondary education right now?
Well, the group itself hasn't yet decided on whether or not we will align ourselves with certain provincial groups, be it USA or CFS. I know that Western itself is represented by USA, but there are concerns with those, some of the ways that USA goes about advocating for change, but so too are there issues with CFS, and this is part of a larger discussion that our group plans to have soon. But what I see personally in terms of Ontario student politics is a lack of unity, and I think we see a very fragmented student movement in Ontario, and this could have something to do with the nature of our representative organizations. We have USA and CFS, who represent very different methods and tactics for going about change, and also different politics. And I think when you lack a sort of uniting body, and we have a fragmented student movement, you won't see the sort of change that either groups are advocating for. And I think we don't need to look far to see what a sort of united student front can do. And I'm referencing here what happened in Quebec last year.
So in Ontario, there's a lack of leverage on behalf of the stakeholders that call themselves students.
Absolutely. Leverage is a good word to use, I think, because I think students in Ontario sort of fail to realize that we do have a lot of leverage as sort of laborers in the university, but also students who can withdraw that labor and advocate for change, you know, if necessary. And we saw that in Quebec, and we saw how effective that sort of united leverage can be in terms of change.
We've been talking with Jordan Koop from the Western Solidarity Network. Jordan, how can we get in touch with you if we want to reach out to you in the future?
Yeah, if anyone who's listening would like to talk to one of our spokespeople or the group more generally, you can email us at westernsolidaritynetwork@gmail.com, and we'd be happy to speak with you.
Thanks so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Everybody knows.